Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline, Tax Breaks in the Works for Some Services. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. With a long list of services possibly coming under the state sales tax, drafters of the North Carolina Senate's comprehensive tax reform plan want to give businesses a break from some of the added burden. An exemption on business-to-business transactions will be written into the fine points of the plan, say its backers, who have yet to provide any additional specifics. Neither have they come forward yet with a list of the services, believed to range from auto repair to dog groomers to the administration of doctors and advice given by lawyers, that will be taxed. The philosophy behind the sales tax base expansion is simple. With an economy that has changed significantly since the current tax code was drafted in the 1930s, not taxing the services sector is like running on two cylinders in a six-cylinder car, says Charlotte Republican Bob Rucco, one of the prime Senate proponents of tax reform. Under the plan, the combined sales levy of 6.75% in most counties, that's both the state and local portion, would be cut to 6.5%. The business-to-business exemption, in turn, would work something like this. Businesses would receive the sales tax exemption only on services that came under taxation in the base expansion. It would be the business customer buying the service that gets the break. To qualify for the exemption, the business would have to be current on paying North Carolina franchise taxes and would have to have its name listed on a state-operated registry. Particulars on how to get on the registry are forthcoming. With regard to the business-to-business sales tax exemption, I believe many of these details are still being worked out, says Shelley Carver, a spokeswoman for the state Senate pro tem Phil Berger. Carver says, however, that a week after Berger and other key Senate backers first unveiled the plan, its key concepts are still in play in tax reform discussions on Jones Street. How much additional the state would bring in by taxing more services and how much it would forego under the business-to-business exemption are also questions that are up in the air. In addition to the sales tax base expansion and rate cut, the Senate plan over the next 3 years would reduce personal income tax rates to 4.5% and North Carolina's tax on corporate profits to 6%. The Senate plan must still be meshed with tax plans being proposed in the House before its provisions are adopted. The Morrisville-based North Carolina Association of CPAs has a committee looking over various aspects of the Senate tax plan, including the business-to-business exemption. So far, however, the group's chief executive, Jim Oller, has declined comment on the workability of the business exemption registry plan, saying, "The devil's in the details." Those details, the plan backers say, remain a work in progress. And below that story is another story that's the cover story in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. And it takes up the rest of the page with a number of charts and graphs that we'll be discussing in the article. The headline, Another Housing Bubble. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. And it also includes a picture of a family sitting on their steps of their home. And the caption reads, Dr. Josh Dooley and April Mills at their Chapel Hill home. Just when it was starting to appear that the Triangle housing market was gaining ground from the ravages of the Great Recession, history and market forces are lining up for another possible downturn by early next year. The reason? Supply and demand. Construction of new homes and apartments is beginning to outpace the region's population growth. That's on top of the fact that current sales are tepid at best compared to pre-recession levels. In fact, first quarter 2013 sales numbers, when annualized, point to single-family home sales being down by 4% for the year. The market has yet to come even close to the market peak in 2006, when nearly 44,000 new and existing homes were sold in the Triangle. The number of sales in the first quarter of this year was about the same as it was in 1997, says Bernard Helm, president of Market Opportunity Research Enterprises, a housing market research firm. There are people who look at the glass as half full. There are people who look at the glass as half empty. This year, it doesn't matter how you look at it, as long as you understand that you are looking at a smaller glass, Helm says. Wells Fargo Securities senior economist Mark Vintner, also has also sounded the early alarm bell that markets like Raleigh, Austin, and Seattle could be experiencing a housing bubble. I'm not in a cold sweat about increases in speculative housing just yet, but it does surprise me how much speculative housing has recovered, considering the pain we just went through, says Vintner, who has tracked North Carolina's housing markets for many years. If the market is in the midst of a bubble, it's different than the one that began in 2007. The culprit this time, he says, isn't the banks issuing large amounts of debt to finance speculative building and approving home mortgages for families who can't afford the credit, as happened prior to the last housing crisis. This time around, it's because fewer people are buying a home and opting to rent instead. For a sustainable recovery, we need more homeowners, Vintner says, noting that mortgage applications for the purchase of a home have remained at 1998 levels for the past 2 years. Apartment builders are responding to that demand. In the Triangle, more than 9,200 new apartment units were in some phase of construction in February, and another 6,300 units were proposed to be built. Yet the average apartment vacancy rate was still stubbornly low at 5.5%. No choice but to rent. When Randy Broad relocated to the Triangle from High Point in 2010 to take over as partner in charge of the Dixon Hughes Goodman Accounting Firm's Eastern North Carolina practice, he didn't have much choice but to rent. Selling his home in High Point was proving to be a challenge, he says, because the housing market there is not nearly as robust as is that of the Triangle. Since putting his family's High Point house on the market a year ago, he's already dropped the asking price by $50,000. Since that time, the youngest of his three daughters graduated from high school, and he and his wife decided that instead of buying a larger home in Raleigh, they would split their assets between a smaller home in the Triangle and a beachfront house at Holden Beach that would serve as the family's new base of operations when their daughters visit. But when it did come time for the couple to start shopping for a new home in Raleigh, Broad says he had trouble finding what he wanted. A lot of the inventory is older, and I was not looking for a project, he says. It was frustrating. The couple, he says, decided to start fresh with a new home in the Glen Lake South community in West Raleigh, which is just down the street from his accounting firm's office. Broad expects to be able to move out of his one-bedroom apartment at North Hills and into their new home by early June. Not back yet. Since the Triangle's housing market hit bottom in 2009, home prices in the region have regained roughly half of the 8% loss in average home values compared to the peak of the market in 2007. April Mills says she and her husband, Dr. Josh Dooley, rejected several lowball offers for their Durham County home before they found a suitable offer 67 days after they put the house on the market in February. I was surprised that people were making offers for what we paid 8 years ago, after we had put $20,000 in the house, she says. We finally got an appraisal done on a house which came back close to what we were asking for, and people finally started coming around. I wish I had done the appraisal first thing. Vintner, the Wells Fargo economist, says that if it turns out that the Triangle's residential market is in a bubble, it probably won't be nearly as severe as before. Much of the new construction underway in single-family communities is by national home building companies that must answer to stockholders and have many of the homes under construction pre-sold. Regional home builder groups have been tempered by the lack of easy bank credit, as well as a shortage of workers and land availability. I think it's getting a little easier to get credit, Vintner says, but every project has to have land, labor, and capital. And now we turn to the biz section in the Triangle Business Journal. A quick glance at Triangle happenings. NCMA to rev up with Porsche show. For car collectors and art lovers alike, there is no substitute for the form and function of Porsche. The North Carolina Museum of Art plans to present its first ever design show with the upcoming exhibition Porsche by Design, Seducing Speed. The exhibition will feature 22 automobiles that showcase the Porsche lineage from the 1930s to the present day. Porsche automobiles, once owned by Ralph Lauren, Steve McQueen, and Janis Joplin, are among those that will be showcased, as well as the one-of-a-kind Panamericana concept car. The Triangle's Bob Ingram, a retired executive of GlaxoSmithKline, is an avid collector of Porsche automobiles. His 1949 Porsche Type 356 G-Mund Coupe will be displayed at the exhibition. The rare collection will be on display from October 12, 2013 through January 20, 2014. Lenovo's Horizon PC becomes the furniture. Folks used to gather around the dinner table. Now Lenovo is directing them to gather around its table-sized PC. The company is offering up furniture into which its Idea Center Horizon Table PC will fit. The various furniture options will be showcased at the International Contemporary Furniture Fair, May 18 through 21 in New York City. The computers aim to connect people, creating an interpersonal computing experience. As the Horizon lays flat, four people can play games together on the multi-touch screen. Duke offers breaks to Peace Corps vets. Duke University ranks eighth among colleges and universities that provide special fellowships and support for graduate students who served in the Peace Corps. A total of 19 Duke graduate students receive tuition assistance and other benefits through the Coverdell Peace Corps Fellows Program for returned volunteers. All are enrolled in master's degree programs at the Sanford School of Public Policy or the Fuqua School of Business. My Peace Corps experience has been very valuable here at Duke, says Ryan Gorshicki, a volunteer in Madagascar who is pursuing a master's degree in public policy at Sanford and also leads the North Carolina Peace Corps Association. The Peace Corps says 682 Duke alumni have served with the group since the agency began in 1961, with 15 alumni currently serving overseas. Cisco signs on to Triangle Clean Tech Cluster. Networking behemoth Cisco Systems has just dug its heels in a little deeper in Research Triangle Park. The company has signed on as a member of the Research Triangle Clean Tech Cluster. Wes Sylvester, Connected Energy Sales and Business Development Manager, will represent Cisco on the RTCC board. Zach Galifianakis hauls him in on site. Zach Galifianakis left his mark on the Raleigh Economic Development website. In the first quarter, his page, Raleigh4U.com, had the most hits with 2,774. It beat out the home page, which had 2,622, an interactive map, which had 1,988, and the major employers page, which had 1,597. Galifianakis, who attended NC State University, helped promote the Raleigh Economic Development Organization when its reps headed down to Austin, Texas for South by Southwest to showcase Raleigh. Unfortunately, Zach did not appear, but the publicity we received was awesome, said James Sauls, the group's director and also an NCSU grad. Looking for something fun to do in late August? If you have the time, you might want to volunteer to work at the Jimmy V Celebrity Golf Classic, which will be August 23 through 25 at Northridge Country Club in Raleigh. The work doesn't pay anything. It is a volunteer gig, but those helping get a Jimmy V tourney shirt, cap, and pin. Among celebs who have committed to play are baseball legend Roger Clemens and the NBA's Rick Barry. Law could deliver new customers to Monitec. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. A bill aimed at making roads safer could end up increasing revenue for a local company. Bipartisan legislation in the General Assembly would require anyone convicted of a driving while impaired charge to install an ignition interlock device. This is a device connected to the ignition that prevents a car from starting if the driver has alcohol in his or her system. If it passes, it would cost drivers an additional $30 million annually. Convicted DWI drivers must pay for installation and monitoring of the machines. Through current law, about one in four convictions, generally those for serious or multiple offenders, result in the requirement to install an ignition interlock. Monitec Ignition Interlock Systems, with headquarters in Mooresville, manufactures, installs, and monitors the devices. There are approximately 42,000 DWI convictions per year, but estimates show only 10,000 devices are ordered annually. 2 years ago, Monitec was the only approved provider of ignition interlock systems in the state. Texas-based Smart Start Incorporated claimed favoritism and fought to have standards changed to open the market to competition. The law was tweaked, and now three companies, Monitec, Smart Start, and Toronto-based Alcohol Countermeasure Systems Incorporated, are approved operators in North Carolina. Market share data is private, but Monitech CEO John Stump says his company has a controlling share. On the other hand, Jim Ballard, president and CEO of SmartStart, says his company will have 50% of the market by year's end. Monitech is part of LMG Holdings Incorporated, which owns three ignition interlock system companies. Stump owns equity in the holding company and is also its chief operating officer. He would not reveal exact financial information, but says Monitech is an eight-figure top-line revenue company. Although a judge orders a convicted driver to a monitoring device installed, it's up to the driver to decide which company to choose. Costs for a device range from $2.50 to $3 per day for installation and monthly charges. The device monitors alcohol content of a driver's breath and keeps a log that is then reported to the Division of Motor Vehicles. Monitech is growing. All the research and development for LMG Holdings companies is moving to Mooresville, requiring Monitech to expand its office. It already moved from an office with 6,700 square feet to its current 10,000 square foot location, and will soon add an additional 5,000 square feet that Julian Bossong, Monitech's chief operating officer, says will be occupied when it opens with additional employees. The company has grown from 60 employees 2 years ago to 100 today. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we have reporter Chris Bagley's page. Bagley covers transportation, law, and energy. And the article, the first article we have, is headlined, Smart Grid Sector Revving Up Again. The Triangle's cluster of several dozen smart grid suppliers is still in growth mode, even amid slacking demand for advanced electrical meters. Their public financial reports show surging revenue, and several of the largest have expanded significantly in the last year. While the evidence is largely anecdotal, it squares with electric utilities' plans to spend hundreds of millions of dollars updating their transmission and distribution systems over the next couple of decades. ABB, the European electrical giant whose North American headquarters is in Cary, employs 690 people at its three Triangle locations, up from about 600 early last year. PowerSecure International, which serves utilities and develops power systems for corporate campuses, has grown to about 700 people through hiring at its headquarters in Wake Forest and at facilities in the Triangle and beyond, from about 540 in early 2012. Most utilities have done less than half of what they need to do to update their grids with the most recent commercially available technology, and therefore remain a ripe market, says Brad Luster, ABB's general manager for smart grid programs. Smart grid, or grid modernization, involves adding communications devices and new software capabilities to utilities' power networks. One frequently cited advantage is that such systems can shut down segments of a grid automatically or from a remote location in response to a storm-damaged power line. Several functions allow the utilities to rely less heavily on field workers, which saves money on salaries and on vehicle costs. Smart utility meters, which can send detailed data on usage and be controlled remotely, are also sometimes considered as belonging to the smart grid field and also heavily represented in and around Raleigh. Some of them cut 5% to 10% of their workforce last year as federal subsidies for meter replacement were exhausted. But revenue seems to keep rolling in for most companies. PowerSecure reported revenue growth of about 35% last year to $162 million. Revenue grew by more than 30% to $5.9 billion at Quanta Services, whose transmission and distribution subsidiary is headquartered just off Blue Ridge Road in West Raleigh. The company vaulted into the Fortune 500. And Power Analytics Corporation, whose 40 employees are split between North Raleigh and San Diego, grew 19% in terms of recurring revenue. The company is majority owned by private equity firm and therefore publishes a limited range of financial data, but company representatives say its annual revenue is approaching $15 million. Most of its recent growth has come through selling expanded ranges of services to existing clients. There's much more clarity around the marketplace's needs and requirements, Power Analytics CEO Michael Nark says. And we have a question and answer section. It's a chat with Arista's Christine Mazzone, and that's Arista Life Science. Corporate legal departments are adapting to the new normal of the changing economy just as rapidly as law firms are. TBJ reporter Chris Bagley recently discussed some of these changes with Christine Mazzone, Arista Life Sciences head of legal for North America since September 2008. The company is headquartered in Tokyo. Mazzone is in its Cary office. Has agricultural biotech gotten any more litigious in the last 5 years? No, I wouldn't say that. There continues to be a steady stream of litigation in product liability, patent infringement, and antitrust issues, for example. As in-house counsel, it's important to choose your battles carefully. Are you any busier with employment law? We have had to implement changes stemming from recent National Labor Relations Board opinions that addressed issues that employers did not face years ago, such as policies governing social media. I've been reading a lot lately about companies paring down their rosters of outside law firms in order to negotiate better rates with the smaller handful. Is that true for Arista? I constantly need to prioritize how I spend my budget dollars. One way to do that is to focus more work with fewer law firms. So is it more about strategy or about saving money through efficiency? It's a combination of both. It's more helpful in some areas to work with one law firm to develop a global strategy as opposed to spreading it across numerous firms. We've been hearing a lot about new alternatives to hourly billing. How much of this is real and how much is hype? I'm a big fan of alternative fees. I am responsible for managing an annual budget just like my peers. Do you think you've had a bigger challenge in explaining legal costs to your CEO or CFO than the heads of other departments have had in explaining their costs? No, not really. I stay aligned with the company's business objectives. And now we turn to Jason DeBrun's page in the Triangle Business Journal. DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. The first headline, Wake Tech Work to Add Classrooms. Admin offices will be moved to building under construction. To open up space for additional classrooms, Wake Tech Technical Community College is constructing a new building for administrative offices. At present, a lot of administrative offices are housed in Holding Hall, the building directly at the front of the main campus in South Wake County. Once those offices are relocated to the new facility, it will open up rooms in Holding for their original purpose as classrooms. The new building, which will stand near the front of campus, will also have four classrooms. When construction is complete on the new building, Wake Tech will renovate Holding Hall, adding 15 to 17 classrooms. Called the Main Campus Classroom / Office Building Project, construction began May 13 and has a 340-day schedule. The full budget is $12.8 million, and the building will be classified as at least LEED, L-E-E-D, silver, and possibly higher, says Wendell Goodwin, Wake Tech Facility Engineering Officer. Funds for the project come from savings from earlier projects. In 2007, Wake Tech sold $114 million in bonds for various projects, but construction prices fell through the floor with the economy, allowing Wake Tech to save money. Construction is being led by Balfour Beatty Construction. Programming and design was done by Little Diversified Architectural Consulting. The building will be 48,000 square feet on three levels and include four general-purpose technology classrooms in addition to administrative offices. The numbers game. Duke University leaders have adjusted financial shortfall estimates for Duke Kunshan University, the campus plan for Kunshan, China, that will offer students Duke degrees. In the left column, our financial projections for the first 7 years of operation made in February 2012, and we'll go over those numbers. In the right column are adjusted figures made in April. Note that the new estimates are on an 8-year basis, not the 7-year plan as originally determined. Higher revenue and cost figures are because Duke now plans to offer more courses than planned in 2012. Plans are for the total subsidy to be split evenly between Duke and partners in China. And the estimates, the total net revenue in February 2012, $82.6 million. April 2013, $113 million. And the total net cost, February 2012, $156.7 million. April 2013 projection, $193.5 million. And the Duke portion, $37.1 million. Estimated February 2012, April 2013 estimate, $40.3 million. And now we turn to reporter Lauren Onsorge's page. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. The headline on the main article on this page, Syngenta unveils $70 million greenhouse. At Research Triangle Park, another giant greenhouse is ready for action. Syngenta, a Swiss agrobiotech that arrived at the park in 1984, has pumped more than $70 million into its new greenhouse lab. On May 14, we got an exclusive tour at what Syngenta executives are touting as one of the most advanced crop labs in the country. It's a 136,000 square foot structure built with a special frosted glass that makes it so bright you need to don sunglasses and sunscreen. It's brighter than bright, says site lead Bill Lavick, explaining that the glass mix evenly distributes light from the outside, displaying the full spectrum, making the greenhouse appear brighter than the surrounding park. And he's right, evidenced by the way the sunflowers, which turn toward the brightest light, face every direction. In technical terms, that glass transmits 92% of the light. Compare that to percentages in the 80s with typical glass. And the structure has been carefully planned from the height of the grow spaces, tall enough to accommodate full-grown sugarcane, to the green light emitting from the exit signs. Plants can't see green light, Lavick explains. When the lights go out and the plants need to be in complete darkness, the green illumination that helps the scientists traverse the carefully controlled plants isn't in the plant's spectrum. The greenhouse can be set to custom temperatures and humidity levels. Specific nutrient recipes can be concocted for specific plants. Below the sunlit level is a basement with what appears to be refrigeration units for more greenery. But while they may give off the walk-in cooler vibe, the units can carefully control everything about a plant, from light to water level. Additionally, they can monitor what comes out, including carbon dioxide levels. But why does Syngenta need such particular controls? To mimic climates worldwide, says company spokesman Steve Goldsmith. It's also about an underlying cause that Lavick can't talk about enough, the fight against hunger. It's more than business, he says, it's morality. As water resources become more scarce, humans have to get creative, figuring out ways to get plants to grow in arid environments. By controlling water, temperature, and humidity levels, Syngenta can test its technology and push forward into the battle for new ways to grow food. While debate rages about the safety of genetically modified produce, the conversation at Syngenta is also one of safety, says Goldsmith, who points out that Syngenta's genetically modified crops must undergo at least 80 tests before approval. Lavick, for one, doesn't expect the ribbon cutting for the greenhouse to be the last for Syngenta here. We're always thinking about what our options are in the future, he says. This is all we've gotten approval for at this point, but the local team would like to do more. And now we turn to the A Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we start with the column written by Todd Cohen, the headline, American Tobacco Trail a Boost for East Coast Greenway Project. The bridge recently installed over I-40 near the streets at South Point, connecting two segments of the American Tobacco Trail, represents a key link in an effort to build a greenway system from the southernmost tip of Florida in the Gulf of Mexico through Calais, Maine, on the Canadian border. What we're creating is a linear park all the way from Key West to Canada, says Dennis Marcato Soriano, director of the Durham-based East Coast Greenway Alliance. Formed in 1991, the Alliance works as a unifying and advocacy organization to help cities and towns in 15 states and the District of Columbia acquire land and to help states convert abandoned rail corridors for trails that are safe and accessible to people of all ages and abilities, Marcato Soriano says. The new bridge over I-40, as well as nearly 4 miles of paths leading up to the bridge, for example, were funded with $8 million from the city of Durham, including state and federal funds. It's scheduled to open to cyclists and pedestrians later this year. Nearly 20% of 395 miles of the East Coast Greenway, from just northeast of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, to Carr Lake at the Virginia border, have been completed. In the Triangle, 90% of 75 miles of projected greenway is expected to have been completed in less than a year. North Carolina also will include an alternative stretch of 390 additional miles of East Coast Greenway running along the coast from Wilmington to the Virginia border. The Greenway, which will serve more than 45 million people living in communities it crosses and already attracts 10 million visits a year, will serve as an urban sister to the Appalachian Trail, says Mercado Soriano. Operating with an annual budget of $520,000, a staff of 4 people working full-time and 3 working part-time, and offices in Durham, Philadelphia, Providence, Rhode Island, and Leland, Florida, the Alliance counts on 20,000 supporters, including 2,100 dues-paying members and 80 donors who give $500 or more a year. In North Carolina, the Alliance has 135 members and 1,000 people who subscribe to its monthly e-newsletter or follow its Facebook and Twitter pages. Individual donors and members account for more than 60% of revenue for the Alliance, while government funding accounts for nearly 10%. Foundation support represents about 20% of the budget, up from 15% a year ago, and the Alliance also receives support from 6 companies, including Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina and Performance Bicycle in Chapel Hill. The Alliance is about to hire a South Atlantic coordinator to help accelerate progress on the Greenway in Virginia and the Carolinas. And on October 25 and 26, it will host its fall national meeting in Raleigh, an event that will include a State of the Greenway Summit and a cross-triangle bike ride. North Carolina and the Triangle are fast becoming a national Greenway leader, Mercados Soriano says. And in nonprofit news, Passage Home, a Raleigh-based anti-poverty organization, has received a $600,000 commitment from Bayer Crop Science to develop a community garden in the Brown Birch neighborhood of South Raleigh and for increased support of STEM education for Safety Club students. The North Carolina Hospitality Education Foundation has been selected to receive an $18,000 grant from the Darden Foundation, the charitable arm of the parent company of Red Lobster, Olive Garden, Bahama Breeze, and other national restaurant brands. The grant will enable the foundation to offer scholarships to underserved youth in North Carolina who are pursuing a college education in the hospitality industry. Chapel Hill's Share the Food Foundation raised $150,000 at its recent gala dinner at the Weather Vane Restaurant in Chapel Hill, with more than 200 in attendance. Share the Food Foundation is a charitable organization that was established by A Southern Season with the mission of fighting hunger. The evening ended with the drawing of a winning raffle ticket for a 2006 BMW 330iS donated by Joan Gillings that raised $50,000 for the charity. And in the People on the Move section, the Triangle Community Foundation named Sandra Rodriguez Director of Donor Engagement. Melanie Davis-Jones joined United Way of the Greater Triangle as Senior Vice President of Marketing and Communications. Carrie Howe Stoltz, Triangle Market President of at Bank of America, was named the 2013 Community Outreach and Campaign Cabinet Chair by UWGT. And now we turn to the spotlight in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. And the spotlight is on banking. And we have an article written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Banks Regain Embrace of Small Business Loans. With the credit thaw well underway, banks, both large and small, are rolling out an arsenal of tools to capture a bigger slice of the small business market. It's probably too early to say that a complete cure for the hangover from 2008 has been achieved. Even so, lenders are making more noise these days about their rejuvenated focus on the small business customer. The push is coming on a number of fronts. At some banks, such as Raleigh-based Capstone and Vantage South, for example, the emphasis is on trying to make it easier for companies to land loans through the U.S. Small Business Administration. Others, including San Francisco-based Wells Fargo and Pittsburgh-based PNC Financial, meanwhile are throwing more resources behind a slate of new small business products. Wells Fargo, for instance, has beefed up its North Carolina staff by 118 bankers and has launched two new lending products aimed at helping smaller companies that may have experienced a few bumps in the road in recent months to reestablish their credit. An already active SBA lender, Wells Fargo is just weeks away from announcing changes in that area as well, says bank spokeswoman Alice Hartnett in Charlotte. At this point, she declined to say what changes are in store. At PNC, meanwhile, which entered the state 14 months ago, a part of its small business focus revolves around a product dubbed Cash Flow Insights, an online interactive offering. It allows the bank's business class clients to track the cash flowing in and out of their companies in real time. The Carolinas rollout is underway, says a PNC spokeswoman. The PNC software tool is coming at an opportune time. More cash for it to track has started pouring into companies, both large and small, according to a survey by Charlottesville, Virginia-based SNL Financial. SNL's Andrew Woolcott looked at regional first quarter 2013 lending trends at banks with assets under $10 billion. So-called commercial and industrial, or C&L, loans, two primary business lending categories, rose by 4.86% in the mid-Atlantic states during the three-month period, as banks launched a fierce competition to sign new loan deals, he concluded. The mid-Atlantic results were second only to New England, where C&I lending expanded by a very large 6%. Playing a part in the credit thaw in North Carolina has been the healthy pace of SBA lending, with some $236 million having flown across the transom from October through April. In two of its most successful lending programs, 7A and 504 business loans, the federal agency doesn't actually lend the cash. Banks and other private lenders do, but receive an SBA guarantee against default. In the aftermath of 2008, SBA expanded their guarantee to cover up to 90% of some loans, but has rolled the coverage back to 75% now with the improving economy. That, however, isn't stopping banks from moving to get more involved in the area. At Capstone, for example, the community bank recently hired SBA specialist Sandy Stedman to help customers negotiate their way through the loan production process. Chief Banking Officer Robert E. Branch says the hire is expected to enhance both customer satisfaction and loan volume. "We think SBA lending is a good fit for us," he says. Good for the bottom line, too. Banks writing SBA deals now have the option of selling off the 75% federal guarantee portion of the loans they sign on a reviving secondary market. The guarantees are bundled and sold to investors. The bank that originated the loan keeps the unguaranteed 25% portion on its books and continues to service the entire loan amount. The arrangement is a source of non-interest income, Branch explains, and one that many banks, Capstone included, are eager to capture. And now we're going to turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have the editor's notebook. Sugata Mukherjee is editor of the Triangle Business Journal, and the column, the editor's notebook, is headlined "Good News with an Asterisk on Housing." As you read our centerpiece on the local housing market this week, think for a moment of the challenges and the possibilities. A quick look at the sales activity would suggest that the Triangle market is getting stronger with every passing month. After all, a 41% increase in sales activity is nothing short of spectacular. But after working at this company for more than 20 years and developing a good understanding of the needs of our audience when they read the paper, we wanted to forward the story. The Triangle housing market is a classic case of numbers not telling the whole story. There is no doubt that the general economy is improving, with unemployment rates inching down in the Triangle and new companies moving in, setting up shop, and creating jobs. People are feeling much better than they did just 4 or 5 years ago. But that euphoria, unless reined in, may result in another housing bubble in the Triangle by 2014. As our story points out, total home sales, new and existing, in 2013 currently is showing similar patterns to the 2012 market, once you annualize the numbers. But one thing has changed dramatically: building permits. In 2012, more than 7,800 building permits were issued. That number likely will be more than 9,000 this year, the most since 2007. So if the sales activity remains the same and more new homes start coming on the market, you know what happens. Think supply and demand. Of course, one factor that is working in the Triangle's favor is that new people continue to move into our communities. Therefore, the pot of potential home buyers is getting bigger. As for the average price of homes sold in the six-county Triangle region, the number is slightly better than what it was in 2005 at $237,245. That number is a little deceiving because the average price gyrates significantly among our six counties. For example, in Wake County, the average price of a home sold this year was $252,058. For Durham County, it was $201,796. For Orange County, it was $304,392. And for Johnston County, it was $158,516. You get the picture. But one thing is for certain, we need to keep a close eye on the housing market. Big home builders are getting very aggressive in putting up units after sitting on the land for a number of years. While it may be good for people looking for good deals on new homes, it may just rock the local housing market once again. And there's a guest opinion also on the Viewpoint page. The guest opinion is written by Dr. Robert H. Bilbro, and he's a Raleigh cardiologist. The headline on the guest opinion: to bring down health care costs, basic care is needed for all citizens. On the morning of May 2, Triangle Business Journal staged an excellent panel discussion entitled Health Care Today. Toward the end of the session, TBJ editor Sugata Mukherjee stated that projections are that this nation by the year 2021 will spend 20% of its gross domestic product on health care. He raised the questions: do we have a moral obligation to cover every citizen? And if so, how should we pay for this care? There was general consensus from the five panelists, who represented different backgrounds and experiences, that yes, we do have an obligation to provide health care for all of our citizens, but that we need to develop more effective and more efficient ways to pay the costs. There was recognition that some of our population are paying the bills, whether it be out of pocket through health insurance premiums, or with tax dollars to subsidize local hospitals or to pay the expenses of Medicare and Medicaid. There is no argument on any of these facts, but let me propose an approach that can help us avoid this distressing threshold for health care costs. If we as a nation will provide basic health care for everyone, not elaborate, unlimited care, but the fundamentals of health care for all, the sum total of the dollars we spend for health care will decrease significantly. If we do a more effective job of early detection of disease and better management of chronic disease and mix in some preventative care, we can decrease visits to the emergency department and have less hospitalizations. We can better manage chronic health problems, which are woefully common, and so decrease catastrophic adverse events, which are terribly expensive. The experience with the Community Care of North Carolina with the Medicaid population has demonstrated that by getting patients to utilize a primary care medical home, they will do better clinically and save costs. And there is other data from different population groups to verify the overall savings in health care costs through providing care for all individuals. We have experience, data, and common sense to support such a step. Currently, a large portion of our population uses emergency departments as their source of treatment of minor medical illnesses or injuries. This approach generates exorbitant costs. Furthermore, the emergency departments are not set up to manage chronic diseases such as diabetes, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, obesity, depression, or other mental illnesses. The panel in the May 2 discussion all agreed that even for uninsured patients, expenses are generated for the hospitals and the doctors, and that the hospitals' doctors try to make up for some of those costs through commercial insurance programs. Obviously, this puts upward pressure on premium pricing for health insurance. The more uninsured patients in our population, the greater such pressure on premiums. In our current system of health care, we pay for the care provided to the uninsured population, but we do so with a highly inefficient, far more expensive, less clinically effective methodology. If we can more sensibly provide fundamental health care for all citizens, we would spend less money for health care than we do now. If we can devise a system whereby all persons have a working relationship with a primary care medical home, they will be on average healthier, happier, longer lived, and with less expense. Other benefits of not having so many uninsured citizens among us are several. With such basic care, we would have less absenteeism from work, a boost for the economy, and we could decrease the suicides, which have become much more frequent in this country. The commonest cause of suicide is medical problems in a person who has no health insurance. I propose that we commit to provide basic health care for everyone, leaving more elaborate care to be paid for either out of pocket or through supplemental health insurance policies, or with Medicare having a higher deductible for the care beyond the basic. Hats off to TBJ and to moderator Jason DeBrun, the paper's healthcare reporter, for an excellent and balanced discussion of the daunting challenges we face to get our system to serve us better and to make us competitive with the remainder of the industrialized world in our healthcare and our economy. And now we turn to the small business section of the Triangle Business Journal. And the small business focus is on Triangle Rock Club. The headline, Rock Climbers Satisfy the Urge at Growing Gym in Morrisville. And there's also a picture of a two men standing inside of the facility with some of the equipment. And also a small picture of the outside of the building. The caption reads, Andrew Kratz and Joel Graybeal team up at Triangle Rock Club. And the dateline is Morrisville. Most residents of the Triangle probably don't know it, but they will soon be living within hailing distance of the largest indoor rock climbing facility in the region. The Triangle Rock Club, located in Morrisville, plans to nearly triple its climbing terrain, which will make it the largest such facility in North Carolina and surrounding states. It all started not long ago when founders Andrew Kratz and Luis Jurege decided to move to the Triangle. The two were in the Marine Corps together and had spent a lot of time rock climbing. They wanted to find a way to make a living doing something they were familiar with and decided that opening an indoor climbing gym made all the sense in the world. The gym opened in December 2007 in a business park off Morrisville Parkway. That's how Triangle Rock Club was born. But that tells little of how it got to where it is today. Like with many new business owners, Kratz says he was blissfully unaware of all the work required to effectively operate a small business, especially with a skeleton staff and monthly bills. He credits the early staff's drive and work ethic for getting the club to where it is today. Being a Marine, you do what needs to be done, Kratz says. It wasn't long before their problem shifted from keeping the lights on to finding enough space for the demand. They had a parking problem, and revenue grew from $366,000 in 2009 to $1.1 million in 2012. In 2011, Joe Graybeal came on board. He was a climbing member at the time and had established a friendly relationship with Kratz. Graybeal had worked in banking and brought that experience to the mix when he joined the executive team. As with most gyms, TRC gets a significant portion of its revenue from member fees. As the membership grew, Kratz and Graybeal realized they would soon run out of enough climbing space to keep all the members happy. It was a tight-knit community of climbers, and no one had complained, but TRC executives knew they needed to work toward an expansion to keep it that way. They dream big. They expanded the parking lot to a size that's larger than they will immediately need, but it's big enough to allow TRC to expand its membership and not feel restricted by space. The existing building has 9,000 square feet of climbing terrain with 32 climbing lanes. The new building, which will be connected through a hallway off the back wall, will add 15,000 square feet of climbing terrain, including 72 lanes with heights up to 50 feet. The current lane heights top out at 24 feet. Although it technically might be classified as a gym, TRC leaders consider the operation a club or a community. Members have made new friends, and climbers of all skill levels can work side by side while still climbing at their own paces. Gray Beal says he reminds all of the operation's current 32 employees that the experience is what matters. "I don't think of us as being in the climbing business," he says. "I think of us as being in the experience and hospitality business." In addition to the expansion, the executive team wants to diversify its revenue streams. Membership dues are clearly important, but TRC is working to book more corporate events or summer camps. With that in mind, TRC is working to book more corporate events or summer camps or lock-in style events that allow groups to spend the night. This would enable TRC to generate revenue nearly around the clock but never become too crowded at any one point. Looking into the future, Kratz has big plans. Those include a plan to open other facilities around the Triangle. The team and members also consider themselves as ambassadors for the sport. Kratz says that only a small portion of the Triangle residents even know the club exists, and few know much about the sport. "We're very proud of what we've done," Gray Beal says. But we have so much more to do. You run a business like you rock climb, you always advance. And now we're going to turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Rayford plant layoffs rise to 1,060, closure set for July 13. Poultry producer House of Rayford Farms will begin shutting down its turkey growing and slaughter operations in eastern North Carolina on July 13, setting in motion the mass layoff of 1,060 employees. The company had announced in mid-March that the company would be closing three of its plants in Hoke County and laying off as many as 950 employees. But the total employee base that will be impacted by the layoffs is closer to 1,060 people, according to the WARN notification letter filed with the North Carolina Department of Commerce on May 10. About 140 turkey farmers in the area who contracted with House of Rayford will also be impacted, according to the company. Parker Poe Law Firm moving Raleigh office to PNC Plaza. Parker Poe's local office is moving next year to PNC Plaza, Raleigh's tallest building, attorneys with the firm said Tuesday. Raleigh managing partner Kevin Chignell said the firm plans to move in November 2014 when it completes its lease term in the Wells Fargo Tower, just a couple of blocks up Fayetteville Street. Its total square footage will remain unchanged. It's about 50,000, but the space in the new building will be more easily reconfigurable than the space in the Wells Fargo building, Chignell said. Four Raleigh builders among largest in America. The editors of Builder Magazine have released their annual Builder 100 list of the largest home building companies in the country. It's no surprise that 16 of the top 20 builders on the list have active residential projects in the Triangle region, including D.R. Horton, Pulte Group, Lennar Corporation, and Toll Brothers. Two Carey companies could go public next week. Next week could be a big one for the 2013 IPO Club in Carey, as two Carey companies, Ply Gem Holdings and Channel Advisor, are set to hit the public market and on the same day. May 23 is the date. E-commerce company Channel Advisor, whose price range is between $12 and $14, plans to trade on the New York Stock Exchange under the symbol ECOM. Building supply company Ply Gem, to trade under PGEM, reaffirmed its maximum of $20 a share price this week. The news comes on the tailwind of the biggest IPO in Triangle history. Quintiles and the New York Stock Exchange Q, which opened last week at $40 a share, Quintiles IPO topped $1 billion, including its overallotment. Quintiles paid Gilling $17 million for use of his Gulfstream jet. How expensive is it to rent a Gulfstream jet? The LeBron James of corporate jets? The answer can be found in securities documents filed this week by Durham-based Quintiles. Dennis Gillings, founder of the Contract Research Organization, gets reimbursed for business use of his private airplane to the tune of $13,502 an hour. Since 2010, the company has paid Gillings nearly $17 million in reimbursements. But don't think Gillings is making millions off renting his plane out to his company. Even secondhand, these Gulfstream 550s can run you more than $30 million. Along with its public offering, Quintiles amended its plane usage management agreement to make a one-time payment of $1.5 million to the Gillings Management Fund. That payment is to change the contract to limit reimbursements to $2.5 million a year. The company promises not to use proceeds from the public offering to make the payment. And for our remaining couple of minutes, we'll read in the Triangle Business Journal the Washington Watch by Kent Hoover. Kent Hoover is the chief of TBJ's Washington Bureau. Comp time or overtime pay? Private sector workers who are entitled to overtime pay could choose compensatory time off instead under legislation passed by the U.S. House on a party line 223 to 204 vote May 8th. This comp time option already is available to government employees, Republicans noted. Business groups urge Congress to give hourly workers in the private sector this option as well. Under the Working Families Flexibility Act of 2013, workers who want to receive overtime pay could still get it instead of comp time. Workers who opt for comp time could use it when they choose, as long as they give their employers reasonable notice and it doesn't unduly disrupt business operations. Republicans contended the measure would allow parents to spend more time with their children. Time for postal action. The U.S. Postal Service's $1.9 billion loss in the second quarter proves that Congress can't afford to wait any longer to pass postal reform legislation, says Senator Tom Carper, Democrat from Delaware. Carper, who chairs the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, has been the main force in Congress behind changing the Postal Service's business model. That could include allowing the Postal Service to restructure its retirement health benefits payments, continue reducing its number of facilities, finding new sources of revenue, and possibly cutting Saturday mail delivery. The Postal Service agrees with Carper that postal reform needs to happen sooner rather than later. And we'll stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.